in New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Ladies and gentlemen, we're getting toward the end of the second week of the KSFR Fun Drive, and we hope to end it as quickly as possible, but it's still going on because we still have not quite reached our goals. So, have you called yet? That is the question of the morning, 428-1393. Have you called 1-866-907-KSFR or 907-5737? Because if you haven't, this will be going on for some time, and if you do, and if you haven't, if you do right now, the Fun Drive will be over very soon. Do we have a report from the control room? How are we doing today?
But of course. We're having a pretty good morning, actually.
Dal Dearman, General Manager of KSFR.
I am. Good morning, Mary Charlotte. I am feeling much better than I did this time yesterday, I'll tell you.
I'm glad to hear it.
And I have a thank you to start the show, Marcy Brooks. Thank you, Marcy, very much for calling in this morning and helping us move that much closer to our $126,000 overall goal. We are, Mary Charlotte, almost three-quarters of the way there.
Excellent.
And we could, if we can just get those phones ringing the next couple of days, we could make an end to it this week. But I have some doubts, too. I think we may well be back here on Monday asking for support.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to be doing that, so why don't you help me out? 428-1393, make a call. We have a really great show lined up for you today. Sitting right here at the table with us is Kirk Ellis. He is the writer and producer of the HBO miniseries John Adams, which won 13 Emmy Awards, two of them for Kirk Ellis himself, and Stephen Rubin, who's a filmmaker, and he's the program director of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Here to talk about the film expo and filmmaking and, of course, New Mexico's burgeoning film industry. So before we start talking about films, what about KSFR? You're both avid KSFR listeners.
I am indeed, yes.
Yes.
Tell us what you listen to and why people should be calling right this moment.
Well, it's really important to have an outlet for independent news and independent thought, and community radio tends to provide that throughout the country. So it's really important that people, avid listeners as well as casual listeners, reach into their wallets and support the station.
428-1393 is the way we do it. What about you, Stephen?
Yeah, I listen to your show when I'm awake. Check it out when I'm. But yeah, exactly what Kirk said. You know, we're lucky to have such a great station and the support of the community. I know that a lot of people in the community do listen to this show and the other shows throughout the day and in the evening, in the late early evening when they're heading home from work. There's a lot of people listening. So,
if you consider yourself a regular listener to the show, and I can't even count how many people have said to me, I wake up with you every day, and I love your show, and I love hearing what all these different and varied guests that you have on the show, and so on. If you have said that to me, or if you have thought that to yourself, or if you've said it to somebody else, and you haven't called yet, I implore you to pick up the telephone right now and make a pledge to KSFR, 428-1393 is the way you do it. And there's wonderful volunteers at the end of the line. But community-supported radio means exactly that. Because we don't charge you the way your cable station, your cable provider charges you, or your internet provider charges you, or indeed your grocer charges you for the things that you need in order to live and be connected to the rest of the world, KSFR is one of those ways. We don't charge you. We respectfully ask you. We're asking you now. We can't do it without you. And hey, man, if we could come to your house and say, look, you got $10 for this? That would be pretty cheap. That would be a pretty cheap way to have radio and have really good radio delivered to your house every day. What about 20? Whatever you can do, please call now, 428-1393. So I want to talk about John Adams. Oh, and by the way, if you call now and only during this hour, you can get a boxed set of the John Adams miniseries, which I myself have been watching maniacally since yesterday, because I hadn't seen it because I don't have HBO. But if you make a call to KSFR, you can get for $125 a box set of the John Adams, which will benefit us and will benefit you because it's really worth watching.
Can I just say that I have a box set and saw it in its entirety, a few weeks ago.
Did you really?
Yes.
Did you do it all at once?
No, I did it over, three nights maybe. I'm pretty obsessive, but it wasn't quite that obsessive. But yeah. It is absolutely fabulous.
It is absolutely fabulous. And we're very lucky to have the writer living here in Santa Fe, has lived here for 10 years. So, first of all, let's talk about, before we talk about John Adams, how you got into screenwriting.
I followed a natural cycle of corruption. I went to college in Los Angeles at USC, the USC Film School. I was a graduate there in both production and what was then called critical studies. And immediately after graduating from college, thanks to one of my senior professors, got a job proofreading at the Hollywood Reporter, one of the two trade papers there. It was a job that was supposed to last 3 weeks, and I ended up staying 3 years at the newspaper. And over the course of that time, I worked my way up through the city desk to international editor at the age of 24. I was also working as a cultural arts reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And that was a period in which you had a lot of movies being made in the 1980s, films that you would sell at the American film market with a poster. You'd make them between February and April when you went to Cannes. You'd sell them in May at Cannes. You'd get money to make another one. You'd sell that one at the MIFED market in Italy in October. And so it was a wonderful apprenticeship, even better than film school, to do that. And so I just call it a natural cycle of corruption. You can't work as a reporter in L.A. Without having somebody say, hey, have you thought about working in the movie business? Would you like to write a script? And that's how it happened.
Do a lot of people do that? They go from actual reporting to script writing?
I think so. Many people do. It's a lot harder to do it now because the industry is more of a closed shop than it used to be. But reporting is a wonderful, wonderful background for anybody who wants to pursue a career in screenwriting because it teaches you discipline and the ability to work on deadline, which are absolutely essential to your continued success.
So let's talk about John Adams. The book was based on David McCullough's book.
The miniseries
was based on David McCullough's
right.
book. And was it your idea to say, hey, let's take this and make it into a movie?
That was actually Tom Hanks's idea. He and his partner Gary Getzman at their company Playtone optioned the book a few years after it came out, convinced HBO to put up the option money for it. And I had read the book separately. Hanks and I had worked together on a failed television pilot, but we'd established an affinity for real life and historical projects. And so when I found out that Tom had actually optioned the book, I immediately made a call to say, we need to talk because I think this could be a terrific miniseries and I've got a take on it. And fortunately, we agreed. And that was the beginning of what none of us knew at the time was going to be a 5.5-year odyssey of making this film.
It took 5.5 years.
From the moment I was hired until we actually got it on screen in March, it was 5.5 years.
What makes a project like that take so long? I mean, I would think that the writing would be a very, very large part of that chunk of time.
The research, which encompassed ultimately about 60 books, including David's book, and included all the writings of John and Abigail Adams and their letters to and from each other and to Thomas Jefferson, and the reading of materials that John and Abigail would have read, the novels that they read at the time.
Really? What did they read at the time?
Well, English fiction was very, very popular. Abigail's favorite book was a book by Samuel Richardson called Pamela, which, funnily enough, is written as a series of letters by a young girl who acts as governess in the home of a rather duplicitous young man. And it's a 400-page account of how she never manages to actually quite be seduced. And it really informed Abigail's writing style. And what was remarkable about those books was how modern they seem. And while the language has a very different syntax and a very different cadence, and that was something that we worked on very, very consciously so that it would sound authentic and not anachronistic, the themes are very much modern day. And that was true of the founding generation as a whole. And I think that's what made the series so compelling is that we were able to do what David did in the book, which was to take the founders off of their pedestals and dust them off a little bit and give them their humanity back.
It's very interesting to watch the film because there you have so many things that we know, namely the wording of the Declaration of Independence, the characters, you know, Ben Franklin is there, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, all these people. But at the same time, there are things like, I mean, the revolutionary spirit, that's a cliche, the revolutionary spirit. But where did it come from? What were the events, and you show some of this in the miniseries, that really got people's blood boiling?
Well, David's book was a revelation in many ways. I think for Tom Hanks and I together, one of the big surprises in the book comes about 100 pages in when you realize that John Adams, who goes on to become the second president of the United States, actually defended the British soldiers accused of the Boston Massacre.
Right.
He took an extremely unpopular stand, but he staked his whole reputation then and throughout his life on principle, the fact that America was a nation of laws, not men, and that is essentially the government that he helped to form. And what was fascinating, actually, about writing that, writing the first draft of the script for the series, which is basically this large 350-page document for what was going to be originally 10 episodes and came down to 7 in the end, took about a year and a half. And at the time I was writing the first episode, there was a great deal of controversy over the defense of accused terrorists in Guantanamo Bay. And the Washington Post, a very conservative paper, came out with an editorial that said any American attorney who has the temerity to defend accused terrorists in Guantanamo should himself be locked up and accused of treason. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I'm actually writing about an incident very similar to this that happened in 1770. So history tends to repeat itself whether we like it or not. And that was, I think, what was a eureka moment for me to say, this film is contemporary without me having to do anything to make it contemporary.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the interesting things about whatever the society is, whatever the culture is that the seeds are planted, and it's essentially, it's the same tree, the leaves fall and new leaves grow, but we're the same people that we were then, and in some ways.
Yes, that's true. I think that we were very, very lucky in the timing of the revolution. That was a remarkable group of men from very, very different backgrounds who didn't have a lot of experience in government, but they were products of the Enlightenment, and they believed in the innate power of man to better himself. And they came together, they set aside their differences, and they forged this new nation, and they largely did it with words. That was, by the way, what I was going to say before ABC and the producers of the Emmys cut off my microphone the night of the awards.
Yes, well, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, and we can get very incensed, as the people who started this country were getting incensed.
Nobody cuts microphones on public radio, right?
What? No, I mean, this is the thing. And, of course, getting back to public radio for just a moment, it is the fund drive. 428-1393 is the number. We're talking to the writer of the HBO miniseries, John Adams. And if you would like a copy of it, it will be yours. We will send it to you very rapidly for your contribution of $125. Make a contribution of any kind, any size that you like. 428-1393 or 1-866-907-5737. 907-KSFR is the number with an 866 toll-free area code, because it is important. And it is interesting. I mean, this whole question of commercial radio versus public radio, you probably have spoken to a lot of different reporters about this program, but you probably haven't gone to very many places in the commercial media where they'll have you on for an hour.
No, that's actually true. As a matter of fact, in our whole press tour for the film back in March, I don't believe I was actually asked to speak before any public radio station. There was a general segment on the show that was done on NPR, and Fresh Air has done some things on us since the show has been aired, but it's very, very difficult to find this kind of time to actually talk about substantive issues. So thank you.
And, well, it's very important to do so. I mean, getting to this question of, it was actions of the British, and it was totally unjust actions of the British, like the Boston Massacre, that led to the people to say, we gotta get out of here, we gotta get away from the British, we gotta rebel, we have to make our own nation. But so the Boston Massacre was one. Where did it go from there?
Well, there were a whole series of repressions that were perpetrated by the British government on what I should point out were the British inhabitants of the continent of America. It started with the Stamp Act in 1765. It proceeds through incidents like the so-called Boston Massacre, through punitive taxes like the Coercive Acts, until finally it becomes simply untenable. And most of this starts in Boston. Now, if you read the British accounts of this period, you'll find that most British historians regard the American patriots as a bunch of rich white guys who simply didn't want to pay taxes. We see things maybe a little bit differently than that. But it was important for us to really establish to an American audience that this was a time in which there were no English and there were no Americans. We were all very much part of the same country, because without that understanding, it's impossible to fully comprehend how difficult it was for these men to make the decision to detach themselves from the mother country and be independent at a time when there was absolutely no guarantee that we would succeed and plenty of insurance that we might in fact fail.
One of the things that I found interesting in the miniseries was that slavery was already an issue at that time, and it was already a divisive issue.
Yes, John and Abigail Adams were the only members of the founding generation who didn't in fact own slaves and actively denounced slavery in both public and private correspondence. But it was not an issue that the founders chose to resolve. As you know from seeing the second episode of the film, in Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration of Independence, there was a very, very direct condemnation of slavery that, at Benjamin Franklin's urging, was removed because Franklin, being the savvy politician that he was, understood that such a clause would never actually pass the Continental Congress. And he was absolutely right about that. But I think he knew, as did many of them, that they were simply deferring the matter to another generation.
And so the writing of the Declaration of Independence was, it was Thomas Jefferson, but it ended up being a little bit by committee.
That's actually one of my favorite scenes in the film. You have a handful of scenes that make you say, I want to write this, just to get to these stepping stones. And that was one of them, because as a writer, particularly as a writer for film, you constantly get notes from producers, from actors, from the guy on the street, from the guy who locks the building up at night. And I don't think people realize that that happened to Thomas Jefferson, too.
Right.
And he never really got over that particular round of notes. There were 88 changes made in the Declaration of Independence in the 2 days of debate it took to actually get it ratified. And when Jefferson came to write his memoirs, he actually wrote out that his original text of the Declaration alongside what was edited, and he wrote very snarky notes about what had happened. So, I mean, it was something that I could really relate to.
Well, that's interesting. So it means that we actually have his original text.
We do. We do. And it is actually quite wordy. He did not use one word where he could have used three. What you see in the film, where Franklin suggests self-evident, as opposed to the long clause that Jefferson has actually written. That's actually true. We know that Franklin suggested that.
So this is another question. When you have, when you're writing about it, I mean, it's not historical fiction. It's historic. What is the genre?
Historical drama.
Historical drama. So you always have to be making some kind of balance between the drama and between what we know for sure.
Right.
Obviously, there was no tape-recorded court, event, court reporter, or anything like that.
It's interesting. Sometimes we do actually have a record. For instance, in the Boston Massacre trial, which you see in the first episode, there were transcripts for that, and many of those were directly quoted and referenced in that episode. For things like the Continental Congress, we only have the sketchiest of notes taken by Jefferson and some of the other members of the Congress, as well as Adams' own diaries. So we know what people may have been thinking and what they were writing at the time, but not what they actually said. And for me, that was the wonderful challenge of this, was to actually be that fly on the wall and to imagine with some degree of accuracy and realism what may have been said in those conversations. And I am eternally grateful to HBO for the opportunity, because no other network would have said, hey, fourth episode, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson sitting in a garden. You're fine to have them talk about the Constitution for 10 minutes. Just stop the action dead. People don't give you that opportunity in television
right.
from time to time.
Right, because, well, this is the thing. One of my pet peeves is any historical drama or any even fictionalized movie about the lives of artists, the life of Picasso or the life of, or especially the lives of writers, you know, George Sand or whoever it is, because in fact, what the lives of artists and writers look like is really boring. They sit there at their typewriter most of the time, and to make a drama out of that with sort of, you know, heaving bosoms and dramatic entries and exits, it's gonna be false. Something like this, again, I mean, that's a great example. They're sitting around arguing with each other, and you have to make it into a drama.
Yeah, the show was actually called an epic, but if I really had to define it, it's an epic of ideas, not of actions,
right.
because so much of the actions themselves were informed by the philosophies of the men who created this country, and you could not do them justice without really paying some attention to their ideas. And I agree with you about the difficulty of dramatizing the lives of writers and artists, and one of the things we wanted to avoid from the very beginning as a production team was any shot that would include large piles of crumpled up parchment on the floor to indicate
please.
That there was difficulty in writing something.
Thank you so much for not doing that.
But it was fascinating. It was a real risk. Not all of us were sure that people would hold their attention through these conversations, but in fact it became one of the most compelling things about the series for many people. The series is now being used in a number of schools across the country to teach the Revolution, particularly the early episodes, and that's immensely gratifying, because that's exactly what you want to try to achieve with a project like this, something that makes history alive to people who find it to be a dull subject.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis, who is the writer and producer of the HBO miniseries John Adams, which can be yours, ladies and gentlemen, if you call KSFR Fun Drive right now, 1393. I have a funny feeling that we have a report from the control room.
Yes, I have some thank yous, as a matter of fact. We're moving along nicely here. Marty Rosenberg, who, of course,
is the
immediate past president of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Thank you, Marty. Don Begley, thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
Julia Meeks.
Thank you, Julia.
Violin Shop, Santa Fe. Julia,
thank you
very much. Leslie from Arroyo Seco. Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
And Mary Springfels. Mary called just a few minutes ago. All interested in learning more about John Adams.
All of you true revolutionaries, we're going to call all our donors public radio revolutionaries from now on. Well, and thank you, and keep calling, keep the phones ringing, because we really would like to end the fund drive. 428-1393, 428-1393 is the number. One of the extremely important, when you say that this is a drama of ideas, how do you put it, epic of ideas?
Epic of ideas.
Epic of ideas is the idea of natural rights, that rights are not given to you by kings and governments, but that rights are given to you just simply inherently by being alive.
That comes from John Locke.
And that was a relatively new idea at the time.
It was something that had taken the intelligentsia in America, if I dare say, the elite who formed the country, took them by storm. And it was this belief that there were certain rights that men held inherently that could not be legislated and certainly could not be dictated by king or parliament. And that informed so much of everyone's thought. There were many disagreements between Adams and Jefferson particularly, but on that particular point they agreed wholeheartedly.
And among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which was a step forward from life, liberty, and property.
That's correct. Now, of course, happiness has a very specific definition in the 18th century. And that really refers to a kind of prosperity, the ability to live the life that you have chosen for yourself. It's not the happiness that we know today. That's one of those words whose meaning has become corrupted over several centuries of use.
Right. It's not how you feel after you, you know, have had two beers and are dancing on the table.
That's correct.
Right. So it goes on from there. One of the things that I also was thinking about quite a bit while watching it was the relationship between John and Abigail Adams. What do we know about Abigail Adams besides the fact that she loved this book, Pamela?
Well, Abigail, like John, left a very lengthy written record of her likes and dislikes. Even though she had no formal education, she read. Her father was a fairly well-to-do parson. Who, unlike many men of that time in his generation, actually believed his daughter should have some education. And so he opened up his library to her. In fact, when Adams meets her at the ripe old age of 17, she's actually sitting in the parlor reading John Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding. And Adams, who had a wonderful ability to stick his foot in his mouth whenever possible, said, "My, that's a very big book for such a little head."
Uh-oh.
Did
she smack him?
She knocked off one of those great sort of 1940s Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell riposts, and he came back to her house the next day to apologize.
What did she say?
She said, "Even a little head can have room for much understanding if there is the will." And he was justifiably embarrassed. And then went back, and the courtship began, and the parents mandated almost a four-year courtship, and they were finally married. And their marriage lasted until Abigail died 6 years before John in 1818. They were married for almost 55 years, and it was a singular partnership, even by today's standards. I know of no other marriage, particularly a political marriage, like it. Abigail was very, very smart. In many ways, she was the better writer. In many ways, she was the more shrewd judge of human nature.
What was John Adams like?
Well, John Adams, I think, was very much as you saw him portrayed by Paul Giamatti. He was neurotic. He was constantly concerned about his reputation, his place in history. He was one of those people who never said no to another duty for his country, and then immediately after accepting the duty, worried that he was not up to the job, which of course he always was. He was a bit of a hypochondriac. He made himself deathly ill in Holland. We think he may have had a small case of malaria, but we're not really sure. He may have had a thyroid condition that led to that kind of illness. But he was a flawed human being, which made him a great character to write about because he's not as well known as some of these other pedestal figures from that period.
I'm glad that he wasn't cast as a sort of dashing, tall, and handsome man.
Well, that would be totally ahistorical. I mean,
right.
David McCullough has a wonderful line where he says that Adams' problem in real life and in history was to be caught between two tall, handsome Virginians. And when you cast David Morse as George Washington, who is in fact 6'4", and you put him next to Paul Giamatti, you immediately understand what happened with him historically.
And Paul Giamatti was perfect for that part.
Thank you for saying so.
He's a great actor.
The initial reviews, particularly our reviews from the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and USA Today, faulted the film severely for the casting of Paul Giamatti. And I think what happened is there were a number of people in the critical community who could not get past their perception of this actor. And so it was gratifying to us all to see Paul sort of bound onto that stage in his characteristic crouch and grab that Emmy before somebody was going to take it away from him. It was great.
428-1393 is the pledge drive number for KSFR. You can get a copy of, you can get the entire wonderful box set of John Adams if you call us right now and make a contribution.
And I get a nickel from that.
Excellent. Yes, that's right. So, my brain just died. Okay. 428-1393 is the number for the pledge drive. Now, oh, this is what I was going to ask you. So we have this notion of rights, of human rights. That's something that virtually every school child has understood to some extent and said, I have the right to do this. And that right comes back from the Declaration of Independence. And we go from there. And not even in the world today, not everybody.
But there's a corollary to that. Adams would tell you that with those rights comes responsibility,
right,
to your neighbors and to posterity, and that's what they worked for. Adams especially was no believer in the unbridled expression of human rights. He, because of his experiences in revolutionary Boston, he had a long-held mistrust of the mob or of unchecked democracy. And so one of the things that I became fond of saying as we were promoting the film is that we as Americans like to think of ourselves as part of the Jeffersonian inheritance, this group of independent agrarians who mind their own business and want the government to mind its own business. But in fact, we live in John Adams's government. John Adams is really the man who created the system of checks and balances that we exist with today. And it's a government that best suits the national character. And he had, from a very early age, a sort of dark view of human nature that comes from his Puritan upbringing, the idea that given the choice between doing right and wrong, man would mostly do wrong. And he needed to combat his worst instincts. And he said that government is nothing more than the putting into practice the control of the contradictions in our own character. And that's how he created the three-branch system of government.
And that we still have with us today. What is fascinating watching this is looking at people breaking away from an empire, and then 200 and change years later, we have become an empire. You know, what do we learn from that? I mean, do governments have natural life cycles where they go from revolutionary to stable to eventually becoming?
There is some cyclic quality to it, but I think that we've come to learn recently that it's not only people who cannot remember the past who are condemned to repeat it. It appears that those of us who do remember the past are also condemned to repeat it. It's just human nature. It hasn't changed much since Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. Read that and it'll tell you everything you need to know about your fellow man.
Getting to the question that you brought up before about authenticity, there you are reading the texts from the time, you're writing dialogue, and again, there's a balance. You have to make it accessible to television watchers of the 21st century, but at the same time you're trying to bring in the cadence and to some extent the accents to whatever we know about them of people of the
right.
time.
Well, I Claudius was a model there. I mean, that's still a real milestone in the portrayal of a period in a way that is very accessible to modern audiences, much more successful, I think, than the recent HBO series Rome, for instance. But it was important to make sure that people understood this was a time in which the written and spoken word had a great deal more impact than they do today. And there was a casual eloquence to the most commonplace conversation. It wasn't just people who were educated. It was the nature of our language at the time, and it was still a very, very British language. And in order to recreate that, it was important for me to simply, what David calls, marinate my head in all of the writings of that period. Abigail and John's letters, and as I said, the novels especially, that taught me a lot about how words were used and what things meant. And you always have to strike a balance between something that's authentic and something that sounds very strange.
Exactly.
And it was an ongoing struggle in the writing of the script, but I have to say it was one of the things that attracted actors like Paul Giamatti and Tom Wilkinson to the part, because they were actually shocked and surprised that somebody was willing to pony up the money that it would take to do something with this kind of dialogue. And Paul was paranoid throughout the entire show that at some point we would just scrap the script and dumb it down, but we never did.
Thank goodness.
Did you have to fight for that?
No, not really. It was because of HBO. They understood it, and that was something that was important to them. They really communicated that way.
Little break for a trip to the control room.
Absolutely. I've got some more thank yous here. Thank you to Pamela Campbell. Thanks, Pamela. And to Richard Fowler. Richard, thanks for calling this morning. And Jake Torin. Jake, thanks for giving us a call here at KSFR. The Fall Fun Drive is flying along this morning.
It is flying along this morning. We would like to get it done. We have to do it twice a year in order to stay on the air. No kidding. It is really not about asking for anything extra. It's about asking just simply for the budget that we need to keep the very small staff paid and to keep the equipment working so that you can hear KSFR. 428-1393. 428-1393 is the number, or from out of area, 1-866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. So you won 2 Emmy Awards. The miniseries won 13 Emmy Awards. And this amazing thing happened, which is you went to make your acceptance speech, and before the second breath had left you, you were...
Those of you who saw the show out there in Radioland know that the show this year was a complete disaster. 5 reality show hosts were asked to MC. They had absolutely nothing to say, nothing to do. 15 minutes got wasted up front in the show, putting it almost half an hour behind schedule from the moment it went on the air. And the producers were very capricious in allotting time for acceptance speeches. They actually danced Tom Hanks off the stage when we all went up there to accept the Best Miniseries Award. But I take particular pride in the fact that I was the only person whose mic was actually turned off in the hall. From the moment I got up there, there was a big monitor about midway back in the mezzanine that said, "Wrap it up." And that's an incredibly unnerving thing to say. And so I was talking as quickly as I could and still be coherent. I had a number of thanks to get out, particularly to my wife, Sheila. And after I uttered this line, thanking Tom Hanks' company and HBO for giving me the opportunity to portray a time in American politics when articulate men articulated complex thoughts in complete sentences, my mic got turned off. Now, I don't know where they thought I was going. I think they thought it was going to become the battleship Potemkin at that point. But it was actually merely meant to follow up with lines about the fact that these people forged a nation using words. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and their contemporaries believed that the right words, spoken or written at the right time, could actually change the world. And in fact, they did.
And certainly did.
And today we have to listen to a lot of bloviating about whether or not words matter in American society, or they even matter to us as a people anymore. And, you know, I'm just a writer. What do I know? But I have to say the answer to that question is, of course words matter. Words mattered then, they matter now, and they're always going to matter.
And so... I mean, was it a political thing? Did they think that you were going into some political diatribe?
I think that there was some concern that the evening would turn into a kind of political diatribe. And there were many people. Laura Linney very elegantly got off the line about the founders being colonial community organizers, for instance. But, you know, if your two leading candidates for a movie or miniseries are John Adams, a film about the Revolution, and Recount, a film about the Florida, you know, Recount in 2000, you're going to have to expect people to say a few things. And it was a golden opportunity, I think, for the industry to appear engaged, and many people did, but too much of it was devoted to nonsense.
And so there was a real response to your having been cut off.
Yes, actually, you wouldn't have seen this on the broadcast because they'd already cut to a commercial for, guess what, yet another reality show. But I received my award from Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, and I'm still recovering from that. That seems like a bit of a dream. But as we walked off stage, Jon Stewart actually shook his fist at the control booth, and people applauded. It was great.
Stephen Rubin has been sitting here very quietly, and he's the program director for the Santa Fe Film Festival. But I want to make sure that we talk about the New Mexico Film Expo, which is coming up starting today.
Today.
So tell us about the New Mexico Film Expo. We have covered and will continue to cover New Mexico's burgeoning film industry since it began to burgeon.
Well, there's no 7-part miniseries, but there's there's a lot of hard work that went in on the efforts of New Mexico filmmakers. Over 110 films, which, you know, when the Santa Fe Film Festival started 9 years ago, there were maybe 5 or 10 New Mexico-made independent films and not very many New Mexico-made studio films. And now all of that has grown so much last year in the December festival, we had about 70 films, and this year we decided, well, after last year, we decided to do the expo this time of year. So it runs today, starting at 1 o'clock at the Film Museum, the old Jean Cocteau, until Sunday night, all day, the 4 days. And there's over 110 films, and there's going to be two panels with local filmmakers, one on New Mexico filmmaking and one on so-called native filmmaking. And I don't know what that is, but they're going to tell us, the panelists. And
Native filmmaking, Native Americans.
Yeah, it's a team of a panel of five Native American filmmakers in New Mexico.
So how have you seen the development of filmmaking over the last few years? I mean, are films getting better and stronger as time goes by, as we learn what we're doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, with this onslaught advent of digital, whenever that was, and how it changes about every 5 seconds. I think they just came out with a new camera while we were on the show. and the filmmakers, you know, they need to learn how to manipulate them, how to light them, all that. So it changes, but it also does the quality of what people can do and you know, how to manipulate the programs and the programs themselves for post-production. It all grows and people's ability to use them. And so in New Mexico, that's happening, and also on a national and international scale. So, yeah, that not only is the quantity of films up in of New Mexico-made films, but a lot of the quality is up. There's people that are, you know, getting to the third and fourth and fifth, you know, 10 or 20 or even feature film at a very low budget level, which is, you know, with 100 grand or 10 grand, you can do so much more than you could 10 minutes ago, definitely a year ago. So it's an exciting change, and I think it's really going to, you know, smack studios around and make them in some ways irrelevant, you know, as people just get more and more tired of spending $10 or $12 at a chain theater and watching half-hour worth of commercials and then getting halfway through the movie and falling asleep or leaving angry. You know, these independent films... you know, these independent films, whether they're 5 minutes, 1 minute, 2 hours, they just offer so much more, you know, getting back to the roots. I mean, they may not be inciting revolutions, but of the power of words and the power of connecting with on a real human level as opposed to blowing things up.
No, Stephen's right. I mean, delivery systems are changing. One of the difficulties that we had with amongst ourselves as members of the Writers Guild during the recent strike is that we had a significant number of members, particularly older members, who simply couldn't get their heads around the fact that young people especially were watching films on phones. It's like, well, who would do that? Nobody would want to. Well, people do. And we have to...
On a screen which is just unimaginably small.
Exactly. You know, you may not want to watch Lawrence of Arabia on it, but the kinds of films that Stephen's talking about, that is the future for them. And I think that within the next 5 years, we're going to see a sea change in the way people look at movies.
Very interesting, because what it means is that you basically, I mean, there is obviously a different way that you make films for TV than you do for a large screen movie, and yet again, sizing it down, I mean, what does that mean? You just have sort of at maximum two people per shot?
It's hard to say. I mean, it used to be that television was very distinct visually from feature film because it was all close-up. That's not the case anymore. We shot John Adams like a feature film.
Well, that's true, because then, of course, people have larger TVs. They have both larger TVs and smaller
screens. So you have to start comprehending that people are seeing things at a big home theater, and they're looking at things on the fly. The same way that they're not reading books anymore, they're listening to them on tape as they drive to work, particularly in the major cities where the commutes are very long. And now I think we're within spitting distance of a time when people will make a decision that they will see a movie in a theater for a premium, or they'll download it into their home theater, or they'll watch it on their computer, or they'll get the DVD the same day. We're coming to that. Exhibitors don't like to hear that, but that is where this industry is leading.
428-1393. I want to remind people that this is the KSFR Fund Drive, and don't forget that the way you hear about some of the most interesting movies in New Mexico that you actually go to pay $5 or $10 or $8 to see, you hear about them on KSFR, which you get for free. If you want to just pretend you're going to a movie, pretend this is your one movie per month that you're going to, or your one movie per week, pick up your phone, make the donation of that amount for KSFR, 428-1393, 428-1393 is the number, or 866-907-KSFR. So New Mexico Film Expo, which is coming up, so it's today, it's through the end of the weekend, many.
But actually, Monday night there's two more films. So.
There's so I mean it's a lot of movies. Are most of them short films?
I guess yeah, about 90% of them, maybe more.
And there's a few feature length films.
There are. There's more features than there have been in past years too. So there's at least 10 features.
And that is just due to the maturing of the
filmmaking
community.
I think it's
community.
Easier to make a feature, not easier, but more financially possible. And there's more people in this state, you know, that have experience on the studio bigger budget level that also want to do things at this level, and you know the same filmmakers getting to their third and fourth and fifth film. So,
and this is happening at the New Mexico Film Museum.
Yes.
And that is the. Theater formerly known as the Jean Cocteau.
Right. Every theater in town has a formerly known as.
Just about everything in Santa Fe has a formerly known as. My friend of mine used to call it the Juan Cocteau. Nope. And that is...
that is always the Jacques Cousteau.
And that is right in downtown Santa Fe on Montezuma.
And nobody knows who Jean Cocteau was.
Oh, well, I know who Jean Cocteau was. Yes, of course. I mean, one of the pioneering surrealist filmmakers. You know, Blood of a Poet, 1930, and Beauty and the Beast, still one of the great fantasy films. Not the animated film, the folks. There was actually an original live-action film that's much better. It's available on DVD. Go get it now.
And Kirk gets a penny of that, too.
But, I mean, what Steven's saying is really true. I also sit on the Governor's Council on Film and Media Industries, and last Saturday we had a town hall meeting with a remarkable turnout of over 200 people, and film professionals and filmmakers came from all over the state, and it was inspiring to see people from Truth or Consequences, from Gallup, from Farmington, from Roswell, all coming to speak to us and to Lisa Strout at the New Mexico Film Office about what they want to see with filmmaking in New Mexico. And a very large majority are interested in two things. One is education and mentoring. We had a number of high school teachers and junior high school teachers who have discovered that film is a great alternative career for kids in rural communities. They understand that it's a green industry, that it's a healthy industry, and they're wanting to find out how they can bring mentors into their schools to talk to their kids in shop classes who may be carpenters, to tell them, hey, you can also be building sets. Welders can also be working on the grip crew. And we have more and more New Mexico filmmakers who are now looking to the film office and to the state legislature and to us on the council to create a system whereby more New Mexico films can be made by New Mexico residents.
So what's your relationship? I mean, you are, you know, an LA HBO guy and have worked on quite a number of films and TV and so on. Are you also getting involved in the actual New Mexico film industry?
Yes, I mean, by the way, I prefer not to be known as an LA guy. That's
sorry,
why I
sorry
moved out
that.
Here almost 10 years ago.
Santa Fe guy. No, but I mean,
for
in terms
future reference.
Career-wise.
Well, in fact, my last miniseries before John Adams, Into the West, we shot half of it here in New Mexico. First three episodes were shot in Canada, and the remaining three episodes were shot in Santa Fe. And it was a great experience. It was a great experience, and we came in at a time, that was 2005, when there still weren't that many crews, and our crew was the A crew, and they went on to do a slew of movies after that. But we've now trained as many as five full crews. John Hendry and the union have been instrumental in making sure that there are enough talented crew members in the state so that producers and directors don't have to bring in people from either coast. And we're also starting to develop a resident community. Many of these people have come out from Los Angeles, have actually ended up buying homes here because they see themselves working at least half a year. And so that's great. And the way you develop an industry, and if I may use a word that's not really a verb, but you hear it all the time, the way you grow an industry is that you create a place for talented people to work and give them the opportunity to make their own films. Because after everything goes away and somebody else becomes the flavor of the month with incentives and tax packages, you have to have that core group of people who are sustaining the business. And things like what Steve's involved with this weekend and the film festival are really key to making sure that that happens.
Quick report from the control room.
You betcha. I've got some people to thank.
Yay.
Donald Perseus and Carla Freeman.
Thank you.
They are big fans of Mary Charlotte and the Radio Cafe. They love her topics and her presentation.
Thank you.
Marilyn Farrell. Marilyn is an everyday listener and also a jazz fan.
Thank you.
Kathy Hirons. Kathy, thank you very much. Frank Curry from Espanola. Thank you, Frank. And Jenna. Jenna, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, all of you.
This is a very good hour.
And Frank is sitting right next to us here at the Radio Cafe, drinking his morning coffee. And we thank all of you. Keep the phones ringing. That's how we get the fun drive done. 428-1393.
Oh, I left one out. I'm sorry. Susan Harris. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Susan. Oh, my goodness. This is a great hour. Let's keep it going. 428-1393. And we are just delighted that about the response to the show and about the response to KSFR. And we would like everybody listening right now to drive the phone volunteers absolutely wild and overwork them as quickly as possible. Diane Karp is here. She has made so many contributions to KSFR with her time and her efforts and her financial contributions. We are overjoyed. And let's just go back to Kirk Ellis. He is the writer and producer of the HBO miniseries John Adams. When you're working, when you are the writer for a project like this, are you on the set? Are you involved in casting? I mean, of course, you're a producer as well.
That's why I've worked, you know, to this point in my career, to where I can actually have a production responsibility on many of the films I've written. Probably the last five I've been a producer on. And you're able to actually shepherd your own script through production. And it was particularly important in this case because I had written all the scripts, and it was a very distinct idiom and a very distinct structure. And there would be a lot of questions to be asked historically. And it pays sometimes on a film to be the smartest guy in the room and to have the answers to questions. And that's always paid dividends for me. And it was true here. But this was an incredibly smart group of people. I mean, Tom Hooper, our director, who was British, who had a very fast learning curve, was instrumental in making sure that we restricted the point of view of the story just to those scenes that would have been directly witnessed by Adams and Abigail. When you go through the whole series, you'll find that virtually every scene is told from one of their points of view.
Very interesting.
And that was Tom. That was really trying to take it, you know, from an epic scale down to a kind of chamber piece. And Paul and Laura had done quite a bit of reading. Laura Linney, who is a remarkable actress, did that entire film in an authentic whalebone corset that she could only wear for 4 hours
before
it would start to have serious effects on her ribcage. And, you know, these women in that period wore those corsets even when they were out in the fields hoeing. So, and she didn't like the corset very much. Couldn't wait to get out of it. But then, in fact, a few months after we wrapped, she went on to Broadway to do Liaison Dangereuse, the revival, and actually ordered us to find the corset again so she could wear it on Broadway, because the one they'd fitted her for just wasn't doing it, wasn't getting her back into period.
That's very
So funny. You have very, very smart people, and you have to listen to their ideas. One of the things that happens when you have really good actors is they rarely ask you for more dialogue. They actually ask if it's okay for them to do it with less dialogue than you've written. And so over the course of time, because we shot the film in roughly chronological sequence, Paul and Laura developed a kind of shorthand, and I would say that probably a third of the dialogue in the script just came out in rehearsal.
Isn't that funny? Because that sort of mirrors the kind of shorthand that people who live with each other develop.
Exactly. They were a married couple from the very beginning. And by the way, it's interesting you point that out, because too often you're asked to write in backstory for people. Well, let's see how the Adamses got married. Let's see how they met. And I was actually asked to do that, and I did it slightly under protest, because I said, you know, we're never going to use any of this, because people are going to get this couple. It'd be like walking to somebody's house the first time, and because of the way they behave with each other, you'll know what their backstory is. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened.
And historian David McCullough was on the set as well.
David McCullough came with his very large, and I might add, growing family. We had to take one whole room that we were using as a bar room set to house them and a monitor when we were shooting on our soundstage in Virginia. David was delightful to work with. He's unique among historians in that he understands that there's a difference between writing history and dramatizing it. And so when we first met, we didn't meet until I was over a year and a half into the project and I'd written the first draft screenplays. And fortunately, he liked them. He said that, you know, it's not important to me that every date's in the right place and that everything happens in exact chronological sequence. But what I insist that you do is that you be true to the people, the period, and their thought. And in that, I think we've been absolutely faithful to him.
Kirk Ellis is the writer and producer of the HBO miniseries John Adams. He's the winner of 2 Emmy Awards, and the program is a winner of 13 Emmy Awards. A wonderful thing. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time to go, but it still can be yours through the end of the news, the BBC and local news here on KSFR. So if you would like to get a copy of this, and we want to thank you, Kirk Ellis, for your great generosity in donating copies
of the
film.
I'm happy to do it.
And Stephen Rubin is the program director of the Santa Fe Film Festival and the New Mexico Film Expo. You can find out more about at santafefilmfestival.com, and you can click there and find the part about New Mexico films. Stephen Rubin, wonderful event that you're putting together. Thank you so much. And is there a telephone number that people can call for more information on the Film Expo?
Yeah, if you call 988-7414, you won't get a human after another hour or two, but you'll get the answering machine. But just stop by the Film Museum or Film Office, the Film Museum, and that's where we'll be for the next 4 days, showing movies.
Look forward to seeing you, and I'll take in as many as I can as well. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, good morning jazz. Tomorrow, Robert Knott. Tomorrow, all sorts of good things. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station, and keep your internet connection tuned to ksfr.org, and keep your phone calls coming, ladies and gentlemen. You can still get the John Adams box set for a little while longer. 428-1393, 428-1393 is the number, or 866-907-KSFR. We love doing the show for you. Please support it. We love doing KSFR for you. Please support the whole station. 428-1393. Hasta la vista. My dear friends, see you later. Call. Thanks. Bye.